It's time now for the Conservative Watchdog Weekly News Review with Dr. Lou Campomen, OC President of the Common Sense Campaign and Adjunct Professor of Political Science at Spring Hill College. The Conservative Watchdog Weekly News Review is brought to you by Spriggs Enterprises, featuring the Shell gas stations in Daphne on Highways 90 and 98 and in Malbus on 181. And good morning, Dr. Lou.
Good morning, Lori. Thank you for that nice introduction and the smiling faces. Good to see. It's a great day. And for those of you who are listening, I want to just make sure you understand this is going to be a good show today. And I want to welcome Congressman Mo Brooks. Good morning, Congressman.
Good morning, Lou.
Well, I also have to welcome my sponsor here. He's sitting right next to me, Kevin Spriggs. Kevin, I'm glad to see you're here today. Kevin and I are going to just take some time with you, Congressman, and I know that your time is short. And, of course, Lori is the chairman of the board here when it comes to delegating time, so I've got to watch my time. So I do hope that that you're having a good visit down there. I heard from Ann Eubank that you just had a really good rally down in Enterprise, so that's a heartening thing to hear at this point in your campaign.
Well, it was very, very nice of Congressman Barry Moore to endorse me for the United States Senate. Barry Moore is definitely from the principal conservative wing of the Republican Party, which is the lane that I'm traveling in the Republican primary. Barry has joined our House Freedom Caucus, and for those of you who don't know, I'm a founder of the House Freedom Caucus along with a dozen or two other Republican congressmen. And we're the conservatives who actually fight for the things that we told our constituents back home that we would fight for. And so it's good to see Barry Moore joining us in that regard, becoming the second member of the House Freedom Caucus in Alabama's delegation.
That's super. Well, listen, let me briefly give you an idea of what we want to try to do this morning, okay? Kevin and I will divide up the topics that I sent to you. And that's basically how we'll operate this. And, you know, try to have a discussion about it. But, again, time limits, we want to get as much information as we can out there. So let me just go ahead and begin with our first one. And it has to do with this whole question of, you know, what legal tools are available to challenge Biden. I've asked this to Jerry Carl. You know, we've seen how several of the AGs from the GOP states are challenging Biden. But is there a coordinated strategy within the GOP where with your Freedom Caucus, I know you're one of the leaders there, but are you intimately involved with these people to come up with a strategy so that it's not just happenstance, individual states doing this because they want to do it or anything like that?
Well, it is an uncoordinated strategy, and the Attorney General's Association, the Republican part of it, they're the ones who ought to be in charge of it, in as much as they are the ones who are in the best position to file this kind of litigation. Now, having said that, private citizens and organizations akin to private citizens, they can also litigate these things, much like the socialists did against Donald Trump for a full 4 years. And in that vein, you've got Stephen Miller, who was at my announcement. He's Donald Trump's speechwriter. He's also a political guru that Donald Trump relied on heavily. Stephen Miller served in the Trump White House for the full 4 years. He is trying to coordinate a legal response team to everything that the Biden administration does. And so if there's going to be a point person, if we're going to have a coordinated legal approach to the excesses being imposed on us by the Biden administration, then Stephen Miller is going to ultimately, I hope, be the point person to make sure that we're able to hold the Biden administration in check when they violate federal law or the United States Constitution.
Well, I mean, I think that's encouraging to hear something along those lines, because I do think that the coordinated effort is necessary. I've tried to get in touch with the Attorney General here just to voice some opinions about where they should be going, and I found it very difficult to make that connection. But be that as it may, I appreciate your answer on that, and I do think that, you know, linked to that is something. I'm going to turn it to Kevin now and let him handle this next question. Kevin?
Well, Mr. Brooks, I'm in business, and I have to deal with these multinational corporations for purchasing gasoline. I mean, we sell Coca-Cola, we sell Pepsi, we sell Frito-Lay, and these are all, you know, very large companies. And, you know, it just seems like they are walking away from the Republican Party and the traditional principles that the Republican Party has stood for. And what are we going to do to push back against this? I mean, it just seems like, you know, for me, if Coke says, hey, we don't like what you said on the radio today, goodbye. I mean, I can't do anything about that.
Well, what you can do and what all patriotic Americans ought to do is walk away from those businesses. Please understand that these officers of these corporations, they're breaching their fiduciary duty to those corporations. The board of directors are doing the same thing. The board of directors and the officers of these large multinational corporations have a fiduciary duty to the shareholders to maximize their profit. And that's a legal duty. And if they shirk their legal duty, then they can be sued by the shareholders for the violation of that fiduciary duty to the shareholders. So if patriotic Americans, conservative Americans, start walking away from Coca-Cola, start walking away from the services or goods sold by others that are supporting socialism, then that's our response mechanism, and that also puts pressure on these corporations to do the right thing rather than the wrong thing, particularly when they see their profits drop in a major way. And then if you're a shareholder of one of those corporations and you want to file a shareholder lawsuit against these corporations, board of directors and officers, then you have potential for getting very large judgment against these individuals who have breached their fiduciary duty, and that would send a chilling message to these corporation board of directors and officers that they better adhere to their fiduciary duty to their shareholders, or they're going to be out of pocket millions or tens of millions of dollars in lost profits because of the boycotts that have ensued, because of their having interjected themselves into partisan politics.
Well,
keep in mind, the socialists have been doing this for a long period of time, and that's one of the reasons why the corporations are so afraid not to do what the socialists demand, because the socialists have been very good at these boycotts or creating embarrassment for corporations that in turn might diminish the value of their brand.
Well, you know, I think that certainly is one of the things that we have to look at. Clearly, you're right about the socialists using, you know, those tactics against people, particularly playing the race card. Jesse Jackson is well known for being able to just go into the board of directors and say, look, you know, now's the time for you to ante up and help us do these kinds of things or else. So I think, you know, I don't know if we want to go down, you know, that kind of blackmail road, but I do think that a citizen boycott is certainly well within our reach and something that we should be doing. So let me just ask you this then. We have been working with various people in various states to put together a legal framework where the states, particularly the red states, become constitutional sanctuary states. Now, I know that sanctuary states has a bad, you know, connotation because of what some of these liberal states are doing to prevent ICE and others from enforcing the immigration laws. But our point here, though, is that the states really do become the barricade against what we foresee happening with Biden. So let me ask you this. Again, is there anything going on within the congressional delegation from these various red states to move the state governments to do what we think is necessary to nullify, and I know that's a word that has a political connotation, but to nullify or at least check what's going on with the attempts to try to circumvent gun rights and things like that, number one. And number two, I know that in our legislature there are some, you know, attempts to try to move in this direction, but it seems to me that they are just bollocksed up with gaming and other things, and some of them are important because they, you know, they had a long time between sessions and with the pandemic. But the point is that this is important. So my second question would be, can you, you know, using your influence among our delegates, get yourself involved with moving the ball just a little bit faster at the state level to protect us?
Okay, it's going to be difficult to follow your two questions when you have them of that length and back-to-back.
Okay.
If I recall the first question, it's whether or not there's some kind of coordinated emanating from Washington, D.C. about what the states are going to do in response to the federal government.
Yes.
And quite frankly, there is no coordinated effort in Washington, D.C. among senators or congressmen. This needs to bubble up from the states. The states are the ones who are supposed to be in a position to assert rights under the 10th Amendment, they're the ones who should be leading that charge. So there's no coordinated effort, although myself and other congressmen, I assume other senators, we do talk to our legislators and we encourage them to do things. We do talk to our attorney generals and encourage them to do things, but that's on a case-by-case basis. Now, what was the second question?
The second part of it was, can you yourself, which you've sort of answered it, get yourself more involved with pushing those bills that I know they're in the House and Senate in Montgomery, but they're just languishing there because, in part because of other important issues. Okay, I got that. But on the other hand, they seem to be, you know, stuck in neutral when it comes to getting anything done anyway. So you've answered it partially, but I guess my concern is that you all have a great deal of respect, and I think that you have more leverage with elected officials if you all are willing to get involved with it. And I guess that's my real point here.
Time is a resource, and it's limited, and we have to choose how we're going to prioritize the things we need to get done with the time that we have available in which to do it.
Right.
We have thousands of bills that are filed in the U.S. House of Representatives. That's typically where we focus our time and effort because that's our job. Do we as congressmen go through what each legislature is proposing at a state level? No, we simply don't, and that's because that's not our job. And to the extent we start interjecting ourselves in state matters, given limited time, that means that that is time that is no longer being dedicated to focusing on our federal issues. Now, occasionally I will mention to my legislators, senators, and House members at the state level things that I have noticed that I hope that they will do. By way of example, one recommendation I'm making is that they not postpone the primary or the runoff date in 2022. No matter how late the census comes down with the data that is needed to redraw legislative districts and congressional districts. And the reason for that is we want to have sufficient time after the runoff for our party to come back together, particularly in those instances in which there's been a runoff that has been hotly contested.
Right.
And if we don't have sufficient time to pull our Republicans back together because of the friction involved in that runoff between the two camps, then that increases the likelihood that a Democrat will win a congressional seat or Alabama House or Senate seat. So when I see things like that, I do interject myself and I give them my opinion. But quite frankly, that's not my ballpark. That's the state legislator's ballpark. And to some degree, if you believe in the 10th Amendment of state rights, then it is incumbent upon us at the federal government level to defer these kinds of decisions to the states. We can share our insight on the public policy, but the states are the ones that have to ultimately make the decision on what they're going to do, good, bad, or indifferent. And if you don't like what they're doing, then the key is to elect more conservative legislators and state senators.
Yeah, I listen.
They all have the same battleground that we have in Washington. We've got a lot of people who get elected as Republicans, but much fewer that are conservative in principle.
Well, listen, it's hard to argue in principle. I understand that. But let me just give you one example, and it's kind of a segue into our next topic. I know Bradley, when he was down, you know, in Congress, went to ALDOT Director Cooper and talked to him about dealing with the bridge issue and funding and things like that. Now, that's certainly out of his wheelhouse to a certain degree, but on the other hand, the importance of the bridge certainly suggests.
I would disagree. That's in his wheelhouse because that is a U.S. highway. It's an interstate.
Okay. All right. But my broader point is, given the direction that we're going in and what we're seeing out of Biden and these socialists, and you nailed it on your when you spoke to us down here a few weeks ago, this is a time where, you know, ordinary approaches may not be sufficient. And so, you know, if these states, like Arizona, has already gotten a protection bill out, I know that we've got one here. So I guess my point is that given the exigency of the moment...
I cannot understand you. What kind of bill?
It's a protection bill, the Constitution, you know, a sanctuary Constitution state bill. That's what Arizona did.
Sanctuary and for what?
Sanctuary in the sense that the Constitution is going to be one of those places that if they come out and try to do something, then state agencies in Arizona are not going to have the funding or the ability to enforce whatever the feds are trying to do. And that's what we're trying to do down here, too. So, I mean, we don't want to assist the feds in overrunning the Second Amendment, for instance. Okay? Does that make sense?
Well, states don't have to. You've got a governor who's in charge of the executive branch of state government, and she's in control of all the law enforcement. If she tells them to do something, they have to do it. You know, when we're talking state troopers, state bureau of investigation,
right.
People of that nature.
And our local sheriff, too, is a very important right. element of that.
Well, I think that, you know, we can probably debate this for a little bit longer, but what I want to do is now shift to Kevin and talk about infrastructure. So I mentioned what Bradley was doing when he was in Congress. Kevin?
Well, Mr. Brooks, I understand the condition of the federal government as far as deficit spending is concerned. But in business, we look at, you know, there's good borrowing and bad borrowing. Bad borrowing is money you borrow, you spend on drugs and hookers, and after the party's over, you have nothing left and more problems. Good borrowing is you buy a machine that increases your productivity and allows you to get a return on investment. The ITN Bridge, certainly the last 50 years of its existence, has been a fantastic return on the federal government's original investment. Now, to go to the next 50 years, we have got to have a higher level of federal investment in this bridge project, because what ALDOT's trying to do right now is, it's just really pathetic in front of what needs to be done, and that is limited by the state's budget. So what kind of...
I didn't hear a question.
Well, the question is, what can we expect, or, you know, let's say if you become the senator, what's your effort going to be in terms of the ITN Bridge?
Well, let's look at things as they are right now. We have Robert Aderholt, who is the ranking member of the Appropriations Committee in the House. You have Richard Shelby, who was chair of the Appropriations Committee in the Senate and now is ranking member in the Senate. They are well positioned to come across with money if money can be had. Now, I don't know why, given the issues associated with Interstate 10, neither of those in their positions as appropriators have been able to do what needs doing. And so I'm welcome to receive whatever insight y'all may have in that regard. But please understand that there's a lot of competition around the country for these dollars. And in this infrastructure bill the Democrats are pushing right now, it's really a misnomer. It's not infrastructure. Only about 10% of the funding out of this huge Biden bill only actually goes to infrastructure, as you and I probably understand those words. And the way I use it is our roads and bridges, that's infrastructure. Our dams, our locks, our ports, that's infrastructure. Our airports, that's infrastructure. But those kinds of transportation needs are only about 10% of what's being spent under this borrow and spend infrastructure bill that the Biden team has put forth.
Mr.
That's not enough to take care of Interstate 10 and the bridge.
It should be $1.9 trillion.
Right.
What is the problem with Interstate 10? What is it that causes the backup? Is it the lack of exits once you get into Mobile County so that you've got the road backed up because people can't actually get into the city and off of the interstate? What in particular is the backup cause on interstate?
You really have two issues. One is the growth in the local economy has, I mean, we've outgrown the original investment that exists out there today. The second problem, which is more of not such an obvious problem, but this is a 50-year-old structure, and these types of bridges do not last much beyond 50 to 75 years, depending on your environmental conditions that the bridge is exposed to.
Well, they're not condemning it because it's unsafe, right?
Not yet.
Okay.
Yeah, you're looking at about a 15 more year.
Now, what is it that's causing the backup? Is it
the curvature in the tunnel entrance?
You just can't put it on the road, or is there a backup problem at the exits once you get into Mobile Bay?
It's just a capacity.
Into Mobile County.
It's a capacity problem. We've maxed out
through the tunnel.
The original design of the, you know, the whole system, that segment of the system, and so it just cannot, you know, deliver any additional performance than where it already is.
Is the problem that so many people have decided to leave Mobile County and move into Baldwin County, and that's putting more pressure on the interstate system? Is that it? Is there just that the east-west capacity from Florida and Mississippi is such that you no longer have the ability to use it for what it was intended?
Well, it's being used for what's intended, but the need, and it is, you know, most of the traffic, I think over 50% of the traffic is, you know, interstate commerce, that, you know, because this region has grown significantly since the 1970s when the bridge was originally designed. So you've maxed it out, and if we're going to continue to grow without creating inefficiency in our economy, we need to, you know, this it's just like building a Panama Canal just so you don't have to run ships or, you know, through the, you know,
around South America.
And, you know, that's where we are. We've maxed out this resource as far as its performance, and the resource is aging. I mean, if we wait till what happened in Birmingham happens to our bridge, then that could cause an enormous amount of economic harm to our area.
Why hasn't your legislative delegation been able to persuade the governor to allocate necessary funds to a new bridge?
Well, the latest allocation is $250 million from LDOT in trying to revive the project. But, you know, the need out there is $2.1 billion to put in what needs to be there, just like Pensacola did.
Well,
after
back to my question,
Hurricane
why hasn't
Ivan.
Your legislative delegation been able to persuade the governor to allocate the funds that are necessary to put in a new I-10 bridge?
It's not a state highway. It's an interstate, a federal interstate.
But let me answer that more directly.
I understand it's a federal interstate, but the interstate funds are controlled by the governor.
Well, but more directly, Mr. Brooks, is that this state is not, I mean,
wealthy,
this state
like
is
Florida.
Too poor to allocate that much money to this area.
Yeah, the bond rating is low. You've got all sorts of issues like that for funding.
And I will point out that the original I-10 bridge, it would not have been possible for the state to build that at the time that it did as well.
Well, the interstate is built 80-90% federal money.
Correct.
And the federal money goes to the Alabama Department of Transportation to allocate according to the formulas that the federal government imposes, certain percentages for interstates, certain percentages for U.S. highways, a certain percentage is available for, say, Alabama highways, another certain percentage is available for city streets or county roads. So
right.
The question becomes, why has Mobile Bay been unsuccessful in persuading a string of governors to allocate the funds necessary for Interstate 10 bridge?
Well, the answer to that would be that they have to take care of the entire state, and, you know, this is such a large expenditure that it just doesn't fit within the state's budget.
I'm not sure I understand why it is just a state responsibility. Could you readdress that, Congressman?
Sure, it's a state responsibility because the state has all the money that the federal government has allocated for interstates in the United States of America.
The state of Alabama.
The state gets the money from the federal government, and then the states make the decision on which interstates are in most need of funding within their state.
Right, which is mostly maintenance related, and they have done a fair job at maintaining the asset as it is, but a concrete reinforced steel bridge has a life cycle beyond which it can be maintained, and that's what happened to the bridge in Birmingham that they ended up having to replace on an emergency basis.
Now, the federal government could, if it so chose, take away from the states control over the federal government highway monies, but a decision was made many, 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 many years ago to simply give the money to the states demand that the money be spent on certain types of roads, but defer to the state where the, which roads the state believes are in most need of that funding coming from the federal government.
Right, and you can't just abandon the north end of the state to take care of the south end of the state. I mean, I'm just telling you, there's not enough state money to replace an asset like the I-10 bridge.
Where is the $1.9 trillion going that is actually allocated for infrastructure if it's not going to be used on interstate improvements other than what the states have already been allocated?
It's awful.
Well,
the $1.9 trillion is different from the infrastructure bill. The $1.9 trillion was a so-called COVID-19 relief bill that passed a few weeks ago.
Right.
The Biden infrastructure bill has a floating dollar amount. Right now it's well over $2 trillion, but it varies from week to week. So we'll have to see how it all plays out when it's in final form for us to vote on the House or Senate floor.
Yes, sir. Thank you. 2.5 is the last
item. Non-transportation needs.
Right. It's really awful.
In the sense of what we consider to be traditional transportation, roads, bridges, rivers, dams, locks, airports, ports, things of that nature.
I'd just like to come back to a second for the issue about the allocation within the state. I mean, you've been in the state long enough to know that there is this question about what goes on in the legislature in terms of division of funding, number one. Number two, the commerce part of this is integrally part of what goes on with tourism in Gulf Shores and Orange Beach. I mean, they're bringing in about $2 billion every year, pandemic excluded, to the state budget. So it seems to me that you know, the golden egg is right there, and this bridge is a necessary part of making sure that tourism business really does function well. Secondly, you do have an issue in terms of evacuation, because hurricane evacuation is real. When we brought this up to Mayor Simpson at this new project's kickoff, you know, I asked him about this, and he said, well, you know, the traffic count is really the important thing. I really disagree with that. It's not just traffic count. It's subjective issues that make a difference. So to your point, though, about the governor, listen, this governor, and you don't have to answer this, but this governor has done very little. I mean, it's my way or the highway on the $6 toll. She came down here and chewed everybody out and went home and was mad for months. And then now they've basically come back and said, oh, now we want to talk, okay? So, you know, let's just say this. The leadership quality that's in Montgomery is zero, as far as I'm concerned. But whether or not that translates into something new this time remains to be seen. I do think, though, that as the U.S. Senator taking Shelby's place, it would be, I think, important for you to come out and say, you know, without any hesitation, that this bridge is important to the overall budget process within this state, and that you'll do whatever you can to make this happen.
Well, I'm happy to say that. And that's been my position. But we also have to understand the reality of it.
Right.
And the reality of it, that Richard Shelby and Jeff Sessions and now Tommy Tuberville, and before, I mean, in there too, throw in Doug Jones. Why have they not been able to get the assistance needed for the I-10 bridge? And that is where the fixing needs to take place. But traditionally, over the last decade or two at least, the federal government has been providing billions of dollars for transportation needs to the state to allocate as the state believes is best. So that might be a reason why those four senators I just mentioned have not had any impact on the construction of a new Interstate 10 bridge. So do you want us to take all the money back that we give to the states and the Congress then spends it as Congress deems best, which is kind of a gamble, because if you do that, particularly since you've got the socialists in charge of the House and the Senate, the state of Alabama might get even less money.
Yeah, I mean, all of those are very quite reasonable.
Request. If you're just asking for someone to be publicly for it, that's fine. But the decision is made by the Alabama Department of Transportation, which is under the guidance of the governor of the state of Alabama, and that's who you have to persuade, unless you want to change the entire system by which we have, at the federal government level, exercised the 10th Amendment and given states rights over that funding.
Right. I don't think that that's what we're aiming at, Congressman. I think what we're trying to do is, you know, in Senator Shelby's case, he was quite quick to find $500 million to do the to help the Mobile Bay dredge and all like that, which is absolutely necessary. I no doubt about that. But I think that it would have been nice for him to find, you know, the same motivation to do what was necessary to find some more money for this project, which, you know, at this point, you know, is you know, he's out the door, and so will, you know, his position as a senior member on the committee is going to be, you know, hard to replace. Personally, I would just as soon see him go and have you there. Okay, that's just me on my view about Shelby. But nevertheless, I do think that as an advocate for this area, I think it would be, you know, something to, you know, figure out a way to come up with this money. I know Bradley tried hard to do it, and on one of the things that happened with him, ALDOT messed up one of the $250 million grant, if I'm not mistaken. So there are, you know, there's a lot to blame to go around. There's no question about that.
So, I welcome any suggestions anyone may have on something specific that I, as a congressman or United States senator, to do.
Okay.
I have not been involved in this like Bradley Byrne has been involved, like Jerry Carl is now involved, like Joe Bonner before Bradley Byrne was involved, or Jeff Sessions, who's from the Mobile Bay area, was involved, or Richard Shelby, who's in a uniquely situated position as a former chairman of the Appropriations Committee and now ranking member of the Appropriations Committee.
Right.
So I see that kind of political setup, and from that, I infer that the barriers must be pretty large for these well-positioned senators and congressmen to have had no success.
Yeah,
I would agree with that as well. But right now, when you look at the funding structure for the I-10 bridge, you know, the weak straw is the federal government. Right now, the commitment is only $125 million. I say only, but that's barely, yeah, maybe not even 10% of the project cost. And you just, I mean, we could always get ALDOT to spend more, and I believe they would be willing to spend more. But you know, when you're this far away, you know, on a $2 billion replacement cost, the federal government just, you know, has to spend more to, you know, commit more money to do this, or else it doesn't happen. And that's what, you know, really, I think the business community here would like to hear is that you'd be willing to try to get the federal government to spend more on this specific project. And we'll, of course, keep hammering ALDOT for more and a bigger share as well.
Well, the federal government has provided the lion's share of the funding for the interstate system in Alabama. The match from the state government level is somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 to 20%, which means the federal government is picking up 80 to 90% of the tab. So we'll have to see how it all plays out. But the bottom line is, unless you want to undermine and change the 10th Amendment states' rights that we've been exercising over the last decade or two, and return control over these spending of highway funds to the federal government rather than local governments and state governments, we are where we are.
Yeah. Well, and Congressman,
I'm
we are
happy to help. If y'all have something specific you want me to ask me to do,
no,
happy to try.
Well, we are where we are with the time, and I know you've got another talk to go in just a little while, so I want to just wrap it up by thanking you for making the time for this, and certainly know that we hope to see you back down here as often as you can make it, and we'll be more than happy to do what we can do to make your visits successful. So thank you so much for coming on today.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Love to be able to help you on the Interstate 10 bridge. I don't want to overpromise. That's not my nature. But if you all have specific things that I can help you with, I'm more than happy to do that.
Will do. Take care, Congressman. Best of luck. Take care.
Thank you, Congressman Bye-bye. Mo Brooks.
Well, Laurie, do I have the hook or
what? 5 minutes.
Yeah, we're 5 minutes over. Well, Kevin, thank you for coming on today. Folks, you just you had an opportunity to hear some, you know, from someone who may very well be your next senator. So we'll see how all this plays out. Laurie, thank you for indulging me as usual.
Absolutely.
With 5 extra minutes. But so we'll see everyone next week. Take care. Have a great week. The sun's out for a little while, so enjoy it. Take care, guys.
Thank you, Kevin Spriggs, for joining Dr. Lou today and for sponsoring this program now for so long.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. You've been listening to the Conservative Watchdog Weekly News Review with Dr. Lou Campominosi. Congressman Mo Brooks is a guest, as well as Kevin Spriggs of Spriggs Enterprises, featuring the Shell gas stations in Daphne on Highways 90 and 98, and in Malbus on 181. If you missed part of this program or you want to tell a friend and listen again, you can hear it at WABF1480.com, posted by lunchtime. This is WABF Now, resuming our regular programming.